Okay, so good morning. Welcome to Narkees Bible Study. This is November 26th in our nice cold room, so we all stay awake. Okay, so I have yet to get the marker, but today we're looking at Exodus 12, 29 to 51. This is the death of the firstborn and leaving Egypt. Then we're going to compare that from the Torah to Isaiah 21, verse 11, until 22, verse 15. Good morning. And then the next reading from the prophets is 2 Kings 19, 35 and following. Then also Zechariah 14, verse 7. So we'll be repeating those as we go, because we'll start out reading them all. I'm warning you that it will be hard to see any connections, unless you're reading in Hebrew. There's more verbal connections in these selections than there are thematic. But if any of you have read it and can say otherwise, that's good too. So we will start reading Exodus 12, verse 29 to 51. Maybe we'll start on this side of the table. We're all fine here.
Where is it?
Exodus 12, verse 29 to 51. Do you have it, Lewis, there?
Yes.
Maybe you could start us.
Okay, the 10th plague, death of the firstborn, verse 29. Mm-hmm. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn to Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. And he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Up, get out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also."
And the Egyptians urged people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians.
And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkoth, about 600,000 on foot, who were men beside children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt, could not turn, neither had they prepared for themselves any food. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years, and it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. 42.
That was the night when the Lord kept watch to bring them out of Egypt. It is the night in which through all their generations the Israelites shall keep watch in the presence of the Lord. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the way to observe the Passover. No alien may eat of it, but every slave bought for money, after you have circumcised him, may partake of it. Neither a foreigner nor a hired servant shall participate. It shall be eaten in a single house. You must not carry any of the meat outside the house, neither shall you break a bone of it. Also, the whole Israel congregation shall observe it. In case an alien lives among you and desires to observe the Passover, let all the male members of his family be circumcised, that he may approach to observe it. He shall be like a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. one law shall hold for the native and for the stranger who lives among you. In every point the Israelites carried out what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, and on this very day the Lord brought the children of Israel out of Egypt in martial order.
Okay. Martial order. We have a lot of themes here. We'll keep reading, but maybe get the picture in your mind. When did this all take place?
Pesach.
Yeah, well, when did the first Pesach, when did the exodus of Egypt happen?
That very night.
That very night.
After
this
dinner.
Is midnight.
Yeah.
Midnight and following, all through the night. So I think that affects the whole atmosphere, our whole understanding of this event. And you have a follow-up of God saying, this is a night of watching, a night of observance. So it's like God is the watchman in the middle of the night, looking out. It makes it like a secret operation, in a sense, even though it wasn't a secret because the Egyptians were eager to have them leave, pushing them out at this point. They were hurrying them. We needed some Egyptians at our house this morning, hurrying us out. But let's go now then and read.
But and Pharaoh gives his order in the middle of the night, and
yeah.
Egyptians have been happy for them to leave for a long time. So he doesn't do this in the middle of the day or whatever in front of the people.
Right.
It's like a middle of the night order to them.
And
so who knows who knew?
Except they let them go. It seems like everybody woke up all across Egypt because everybody had someone dead, and they all realized it. And Pharaoh summons them at night. Yeah, this all takes time. He summons them, tells them, get out of here, not just you, all of the Israelites, all your animals.
And your motley crew, whatever that was.
Yeah, and notice the animals.
Right.
Yeah, the motley crew.
Those were probably people, you remember when the hail was coming?
Yeah.
And they started to believe, they were like converting, and they went out with the Israelites. But nowadays, whenever the Jews do something weird, people will say, oh, they're from the mixed multitude.
Right? Yeah.
They're not true Israelites, they're from the mixed multitude.
Well.
Maybe all those liberals in America are from the mixed multitude.
It's interesting, the word Erev, because it's also a homonym with the word evening. Both kind of in our theme, because Pesach is done in the evening time. And Erev ties into, we were talking about the meaning of Arov, what this mixture, the plague of Arov was. It was either flies or a mixture of wild beasts. In this case, it's a mixture of peoples. Some people, like I think the Net Bible notes, maybe it is other slaves in Egypt who aren't Israelites, but who see their opportunity for freedom. Or like you say, maybe some of the Egyptians themselves who have started to believe, because this God is so amazing, like nothing they've seen before, I'm going to go with those people.
Well,
yeah.
Even Pharaoh says, bless me. You know,
yeah.
He begins to wake up and he says, bless me also.
Yeah.
And they're afraid that now it's killed the firstborn, it's going to kill everybody if they don't get out of there.
Right. So bless me so I don't die. Now that you killed my kid. An interesting theme is that the animals. Notice that it's not just a firstborn of Pharaoh and his family. It's a firstborn of even the captives who aren't Egyptian, sitting in Egyptian jails. It's unanimous. It's everybody under Egypt rule.
If it's anybody who doesn't have blood on the door.
Right. And, I'm not sure. Maybe the Egyptians who were starting to believe did go join Israelites and their families. I don't know. But the animals, too. The firstborn of every animal was killed. It just reminds me of Nineveh. You know, in God's parting words to Jonah, he says, shouldn't I care about 120,000 people and so many animals? It's like there's always a people and the animals. And what the people do affects the animals as well. Obviously, you have the flood story. You have the Exodus of Egypt, the death of the firstborn. The Egyptian animals hurt because of the people.
Israelite animals, the firstborn dead?
No. No, but the Egyptians did.
Specifically, I think he says so.
It says all the animals of the Egyptians, right? Let's see, where were we reading? It's strange because it repeats itself. We've already had the law of Passover before the actual telling of the event. So the law's already told us you're supposed to make unleavened bread, and now we have the telling of the event, which kind of gives an idea why, because you're all rushed out. There was no time to make leavened bread. And I was also thinking about slavery. You know, in Deuteronomy, it calls it the bread of affliction, lechem oni. And the word oni there is also poverty. They're related roots. Whether you say poverty or affliction, we have it in the Passover meal. You say, this is the bread of affliction. And that's where Jesus probably said, this is my body broken for you. I was saying, you have the bread of affliction. Like, if you're working as a slave all day, you don't have time to make yourself bread, basically. Because bread takes effort. You have to sit, let it rise, come back, do something, leave, come back. And if you're out in the field as a slave, you basically, you know, can make yourself a pancake or whatever this was, unleavened bread, unleavened pita. You throw it on the taboon, whatever you do, and eat it quickly because you just don't have the time. And so in either case, whether you're leaving in the middle of the night and don't have time, or if it's a daily practice, it's that symbol of slavery and poverty. So, what else can we pick out before we move on? This very day, well, God being a watchman, this idea of observing. And who can partake of it?
Yeah, I didn't remember that. I didn't remember that you had to be circumcised, you had to join. You know, because they often say, and the slaves within you, you'll take, you know, you'll be generous to them, you'll
right.
give them pardon, you'll give them rights and justice.
Right.
And this is so exclusive.
It seems exclusive, and yet there are clearly different words being used. Like, if you look in verse 43, God says to Moses and Aaron, this is the law of the Passover. Every son of a foreigner, and it uses the word nechav. These are foreigners. This term is maybe more equivalent to what you think when you think of pagan. They're just complete foreigners, complete don't understand, don't respect the God of Israel. Later, though, in 45, it says, Toshav v'sachir lo yochal bo. So the resident and the hired worker won't eat of it. So that's interesting. So are these are clearly foreign residents and foreign workers. Wouldn't be another Israelite worker. So it seems that these words would be then more short-term kind of residents, maybe travelers, traders, because following that, it actually says that the ger, if someone lives with you, a ger lives with you, he can do the Pesach. He just needs to be circumcised.
Yes.
So what's the word for foreigner before ger?
Well, they use nechar. The first word for foreigner is nechar.
Okay.
Then the toshav and the sachir. All of those cannot, but the ger can. And of course, later Judaism interprets ger to be a convert to Judaism, maybe in part because of passages like this, where it's not just a foreigner living in Israel. It's more of a long-term, I'm seconded to this place and people, because
they call it ger tzedek.
Ger what?
Ger tzedek.
Ger tzedek.
But a lot of people say it's true, but it doesn't belong.
Well, here there's no mention of it being tzedek or not, whether it's a righteous Gentile or, ger, a righteous foreigner or stranger, or just, it's just the stranger that lives with you. Who have we read about in Genesis who is basically a ger in this country? If you look, let's see. I didn't look up that verse, but Abraham is a ger. He comes to this country to live, and he intends to stay, but he's a ger. He is not native born.
Ger toshav.
There is the phrase ger toshav, and I'm sure if Brian Kovaznica were here this morning, he could really get excited about defining all these terms for us. But here, toshav and ger are different, because the toshav and the sachir may not eat the Pesach, and the ger may. So a ger is someone who is a foreigner, but living here kind of more or less permanently, or living with the people of Israel, in this case.
Yeah, but the ger must be, because he's circumcised, he has to be circumcised. So he must, he must be a convert.
He may not have been circumcised, because it says, if a ger lives with you, he will do the Pesach, you must circumcise him.
Yes, it says they have to be, it says that all his males be circumcised.
Right. But when he first moved, he might not have been circumcised, but when he wants to do the Passover with you, he needs to be circumcised.
For no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. So
right.
It's saying you can't do it until you get circumcised.
Right. But the circumcision doesn't make him an ezrach, as it says in the rest of the verse. The ezrach, the native born, which today they use this term for, what's the word we use? No, what's it about? Citizen. We use the word citizen. So you have a native born, and you have this foreign implant, the foreign person who lives here. And they're supposed to have one law. But it doesn't actually erase who they are. There is still a native born and a foreigner, but they're both going to be circumcised and partake of the Pesach. Now, obviously, this law is written down after the fact and in anticipation of living in the land of Israel. That first Pesach in Egypt, there was no foreigner resident because they're all in a different land. They're not even in this land yet. So it's kind of the laws have been put back right into the middle of the story as it's progressing. It's an interesting thing to think about. Also in the middle of the night, it talks about God pulling out his ranks, his people. It uses military terms. 600,000 gvarim. The emphasis is on kind of like more of the strong men, not just any old person. And then it says besides the children. So you could say that's just 600,000 males in general, but it's followed by the last verse saying God brought out his ranks or his regiments. You almost have, it almost seems like they're ready for war when they're leaving Egypt. And of course you have the famous phrases in here, plundering Egypt. They take gold and silver. Anything they asked for, apparently, the Egyptians gave to them. They use lehashil, which is normally to lend, but in this context, they're not really lending. They're not going to get it back. They're basically giving it. But gold, silver, and clothes. And that's, of course,
they're no longer going out to sacrifice because Pharaoh says go. You know, the deal was always to go to sacrifice for a few
right.
days.
Well, that's a good question because there isn't a time limit on it. But he does say, go sacrifice to your God, just as you said. So if they were asking to go out,
take your flocks and
and your children and everything.
Yeah.
So you have permission to take everything with you, but go just as you have said. So it's still kind of ambiguous. But I think that the understanding was always that they would just be going for good. Otherwise, why would Pharaoh have said no in the first place? Why not just let them go 3 days if they're going to come back?
Why wouldn't he just go round them up anyway, which is what he eventually does?
What he tries to do, yeah. Yeah, good question.
You know, if you're blind more than 3 days, then
right,
we'll kill you.
And they have, you know, watch fortresses all along the main highway to the land of Canaan, which of course is not the way they went. Yeah, so there's many questions there. Why Pharaoh didn't just let it go and figure he could round them up. But again, there's this fear that they're so big and powerful. There's so many of them now. And that was the fear in the first place. Okay, so let's read our other verses. Sorry, I still don't have that pen. Isaiah 21:11 through 22:15.
Oh, Isaiah 11.
21:11. So we start in verse 11 and we go through to chapter 22:15. And it's hard to jump into the middle of Isaiah. For one, it's poetry. It's hard to understand. You need kind of like a background. And things can be stuck together out of time or in different time. It's hard to get back into it. But we basically have two prophecies here. One is to the area of Duma in northern Arabia. And this is kind of down, if you go past Edom as you're going south, it's at basically Saudi Arabia today, the top of Saudi Arabia. And Seir, if you remember, is also another name for Edom. So let's go ahead and read that. Where shall we start? Let's start. Do you have English here?
I do.
Okay, go ahead, Philip, and read for us.
A prophecy about Duma. Someone is calling to me from Seir. Watchman, how much longer is it night? Watchman, how much longer is it night? The watchman answers, morning is coming, but also the night. If you want to ask, ask. Come back again. A prophecy about Arabia. You caravans of the Damim will camp in the desert growth of Arabia. Bring water to the thirsty, you who live in Tama. Greet the fugitives with food, because they are fleeing the sword, the drawn sword, the bent bow, and the press of battle. For this is what Adonai has told me. Within a year, and not a day more, as if a hired worker were keeping track of the time, the glory of Kedar will come to an end. Few of Kedar's valiant archers will be left. Adonai, the God of Israel, has spoken.
Okay, and Kedar is also in the south. These are words associated with Midian, Arabia. And Dedan is also referring to that area. Maybe a mixture of tribes. You think of the caravan routes. And just to give you a picture, I made a map from... The words are in Hebrew, but don't worry. I just want to give you a picture of the land. So, this is Israel up here. This little bit, and there's a whole Saudi Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Here is Kedar. There's Eilat. Mm-hmm. All that. And so underneath from Eilat down, that's all Midian. And it's also Dedan. And so then the two, Duma was mentioned, that city there, and Tema, this city here, those two dots. So if you see the double dashed lines, those are caravan routes, supposedly. And so these people, the Dedanites, would be the ones going on the main highways back and forth, you know, bringing spices and balms and whatever the south is known for. It's known for also, Ophir is known for its gold way down here. So, spices and precious metals. And here, the person calling from Seir seems to be a messenger. Duma, if you look up here, this is basically, let's see. It's more towards the way to Babel. And maybe this whole prophecy is the people that are in between Babylon and Israel. They're going to be like the messengers of what's coming. In the commentary I read, they place this historically in the... There was a rebellion of Merodach Baladan. And that's the time frame they put it in. But it's interesting that it starts... What are the first words of the prophecy? Someone is calling out from Seir, from Edom. And what does he say? Shomer, what's from the night? Shomer, what's from the night? And it's poetic because he repeats himself and he says, Ma min halayla, ma min milel. And lel is both construct for night in Hebrew, but it also appears on its own as kind of a poetic other way to say night. I don't know if we... Do we have two ways of saying night in English?
Evening.
No, evening is evening, but... Night and night. I don't know. So this, I think, is the first thing that connects us up with our prophecy, because you have our prophecy, our initial text, because you have an event, a divine event, happening at night. But in this case, the night is a metaphor, because he's asking, the watchman is a person who normally knows what time of night it is exactly. Someone who wakes up in the middle of the night can be quite clueless about what time it is. It could be, you know, midnight, feels like you've slept forever, or it could be 4 a.m. So you ask the watchman, hey, how much more is there going to be night? How much more time? Or how much of the night has already passed? And so if you view night as trouble, it could be war, trouble, tribulation, something, they're asking, how much of it is gone? And what does he answer? It's the strangest answer.
Morning is coming, but also night.
Yeah, morning is coming, but also night. Ata voker vegam laila. So what does that mean? There's going to be a reprieve, but then it's still going to be trouble? And then if you want to ask, ask. Come back. And he uses some Aramaicizing language here. Not, I don't know why, if he is kind of, because he's talking about the East and, you know, what's happening in Babylon that's going to spill over into these other areas. I don't know. But then he starts talking about all these trade routes and what's going to happen to the trade routes. Like, why are they camping in the thicket of Arabia? Which actually it says forest of Arabia. But as you know, there are not great forests in Arabia. So it basically means off the main highways. Because traders would be traveling up and down the highways. Maybe there's hotels or some type of camping spot you could rest in. But when there is war and bad things happening, you do not want to be found. And so you tend to hide. And so they're leaving the highways and going out into the wastelands or into the forests, if you will, the uninhabited areas. And I suppose that's why it says, bring out some water for the thirsty, you who lived in the land of Tema. So people are getting lost in the desert and they're not finding water and they're not finding food. And so some of the local towns have to come out and bring them stuff. because they're fleeing the sword.
Whose sword are they fleeing?
Well, I guess apparently Babylon. I'm not quite sure. But
it says Babylon is fallen.
Yeah. But I think it's because they're caught in the middle.
It's just chaos for them.
It's chaos, yeah.
People are attacking each other.
Now later, is it this one? The first one is Masa Duma, and then we keep reading An Kedar to the Valley of Vision. One of them talks to, did we already read about Tsor? Sorry, not Tsor. It says Tsori, put a siege. It calls Elam and Madai to come put a siege.
Verse 2? No, that's further.
No, that's further down.
Yeah.
And so these would have been allies to Babylon. So it's kind of calling to them, mocking, like, yeah, come put a siege on Assyria. But, like, you can't do it because the big person that you're allied with has just fallen. Babylon's fallen, so there's nothing you can do about it. So it seems to be the wars between Ashur and Babel, but somehow everyone in the region is affected.
Even so far in the south?
I suppose so, because it's a trade route. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to study the whole background of this particular situation more, which I haven't done today. But also coming at it from a perspective of how it lines up with the Exodus is interesting. You have the same thing happening at night, but here the night is a metaphor. And I suppose even in Exodus, the night could be a metaphor, right? Because it's slavery they're leaving from. It's a hardship. Where whether it's war on the one hand or slavery, the end result is you feel you're not free to do what you want, you can't just live your life, and you're trying to get away from it. And it's kind of, it's scary. Things that happen at night are scarier somehow. You don't have your same wits about you. I don't know if anybody here has had kids. When a kid is sick in the middle of the night, you get much more panicked than when they're sick at daytime. I don't know why. It could be the same thing. But at night, you just feel out of control. You know, do I need to go to the hospital or someone be open? There's this weird sense of you don't know what's going on. And so some of that, I think, is infusing our texts. We're talking about people having conversations in the middle of the night about disasters and trouble and what's going on. How long is it going to last? Also, in this case, there, in this prophecy, the person, the messenger from Seir, is calling out to the shomer, to the watchman. And in a sense, it seems like that is a picture of the prophet. Hey, prophet, how long is this going to last? You're the watchman. You're supposed to know these things. When is the night going to be over? And he gives this very vague answer.
So is the night referring to this conflict?
It seems to be, the troubles that they're in. He says, yeah, morning's coming, but then night. If you want to ask, ask. Like, what kind of answer is that? Come back and ask again. You know, it's not much clarity.
See, turn from evil ways, turn, or just...
Well, return.
Just come back.
I mean, it's always open for interpretation, but in the context, it seems come back and ask again. But it really says come back and bring it. Like if you have a request, come back and bring it. Like again using kind of very, besides the come back word, a lot of it's very Aramaic like words. Okay, so also in terms of verbal links, we have the night theme and we have the hired hand is mentioned, that was mentioned in our Pesach text of someone who may not eat the Passover. So in verse 16, within exactly 1 year, all the splendor of Kedar will come to an end. Just a handful of archers, the warriors of Kedar, will be left. Wait, why don't I have that in 16? My verses are off. Okay, wait. Isaiah 21, in my verse 16. Oh, okay. That's why I don't have it. They blended it right out. What do you have in verse 16?
For this truth, Adonai has told me, within a year, not a day more, as if a hired worker were keeping track of the time.
Okay, as if a hired worker were keeping track of the time. Good. My translation just took that out and said within exactly 1 year. So, again, a hired worker would definitely keep track of the time because it's in his interest. He doesn't want to work longer than he needs to work. And the same concept of the watchman would know when the morning's coming because his shift will be over. You know, he's excited about it. And so it's a way of saying in exactly 1 year. But that word, sachir, is mentioned in our Pesach text. So that could also be one of the links, even though it's used in a very different way.
Doesn't it? In 17, they have
Gvarim?
Gvarim. What's it say?
Which verse are you in?
Gvarim, the name of Kedar, the heroes.
Yeah, the mighty men, the heroes.
Yeah, they had that Exodus too, didn't they?
A similar word, yes. Gvarim. It's not Giborim, but they are related. Gvarim is men, but specifically men and not like humans. And it has more of the concept of strength there, if you look at the root. Okay, did we read the next one?
No.
The Valley Vision?
Should I continue on?
Sheila, why don't you go ahead and...
A message concerning the Valley Vision. What troubles you that all of you have climbed upon the housetops, you full of noise, a tumultuous city, an exultant town? Your slain have not been slain by the sword, nor have they died in battle. All your leaders have fled together. Without a bow, they have been captured. All those of him whom they overtook were made captive together, even those who had fled far away. Therefore, I said, turn your gaze from me as I weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me because of the devastation of the daughter of my people. For a day of confusion, downtreading, and perplexity from the Lord God of hosts is in the valley of vision, crashing down of walls and shouting to the mountains.
Shouting to the mountain, let's see.
Elam has taken up the quiver with the chariots, infantry, and horsemen. Kir has uncovered the shield. Your choice valleys were filled with chariots. Your horsemen set themselves in array against the gate. Then he removed the covering of Judah, and you looked for weapons in the house of the forest. You saw that the breaches in the walls of the city of David were numerous. You also collected the waters of the lower pool, counted the houses of Jerusalem, and broke down houses to fortify the wall. You made a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the old pool, but you did not look to the maker of it, nor did you recognize him who planned it long ago. Therefore, at that time, the Lord of hosts, called you to weeping and lamenting, to baldness, into the girding on of sackcloth. But instead, see pleasure and mirth, the slaying of cattle and killing of sheep, eating meat and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. The Lord of hosts has revealed in my ears, surely this iniquity will not be atoned for by you until you die, says the Lord of hosts. Thus says the Lord of hosts, come, go over to this steward, to Shebna, who is over the palace, and say.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, that last verse seems to be not included because there's a petucha, the the paragraph division falls right before verse 15, so I don't know why that's in our reading. But maybe it was a little bit. Isaiah 22. So again, the focus is on Jerusalem, and if this is the Assyrians who've just overthrown Babylon, maybe it's, you know, they're coming to get you too. And they're preparing for a siege. They're tearing down houses to reinforce the wall. But the key there is in verse 11. You didn't trust in the one who made that pool. There's a spring, you know, the Shiloach. It's like God's the one that makes the pool and the waters and all of that. And that's the one you're supposed to depend on, nothing else. And he commands armies, Adonai Tzvaot. And when you think about it, we have this army depiction again. Even the children of Israel are like his army. As funny as that seems, because they're just a people group, they're not, everyone isn't necessarily a trained warrior, but they're God's army. And you have also sacrifices going on. 13. They're slaughtering. Well, let's say sacrifice-related words. They're slaughtering sheep and cows. They're eating meat and drinking wine, which is what you would do at a celebration.
It's saying that you see this disaster coming. It's like a,
and in this case, it's bad. It's a negative image, right?
It's like with I watched this thing on Thanksgiving because I had to do a thing at my daughter's school. And they said that the early Thanksgiving, it came from England, and what they wanted to get rid of all the Catholic holidays. So what they had was they had days of fasting, and they had days of Thanksgiving. If something bad was going to happen, they fasted.
Right.
If something good happened, they had Thanksgiving.
Right.
So that's what it's saying here. You should have been fasting.
You should have been seeking God. When you see this trouble, you should be seeking God and not just thinking, oh, well, you know, let's just eat and drink because tomorrow we die.
That's a pretty big sin. It says because of that, you will die.
It's interesting, though, because if you were in the people's position, what would you have said? If a big superpower is going to invade this little country, specifically Jerusalem, the very normal thing to do would be like, we're toast.
It's probably a good time to turn to God, right?
It is a good time to turn to God, yes. Even if you are toast, as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said.
Because God can save toast.
God can save toast before it burns. Yeah, out of the toaster. Yeah. It's true. So these are interesting passages to be connected to our passage.
All about lack of faith.
There's
faithfulness.
Lack of faith, yeah. Lack of turning to God. And there's God doing miraculous deeds to the enemies of Israel. In the middle of the night. And
it's like the opposite coin. You know, you're ordered to do this, you're going to do this.
So let's look then in verse 2 Kings 19:35.
First Kings.
Second Kings. Second Kings 19:35 and following. Okay, so this is also.
This connects because it's the angel of the Lord, right? What else?
Yeah. Well, this is also, if you look back up to verse 20 in 2 Kings 19, this is a message to Hezekiahu, the king, saying, I have heard your prayer concerning King Sanherib of Ashur. So the Assyrian king Sanherib. So it seems to be the same time. But in this case, Hezekiah is praying, he's turning to God, because God says, I've heard your prayer concerning the king. And this is what he says about him. Then we go down to verse 35. And who wants to read for us? Verse 35.
And it came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses all dead.
Okay, and then read also the next two verses.
So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the temple of Nisroch, his god, that his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer struck him down with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. Then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place.
Okay, so we have the king's ultimate downfall. But that one little verse has a lot of connector things for us. What's the one obvious one?
The angel of the Lord smiting them.
Okay, the angel of the Lord. Even though in our text it didn't mention the angel, it mentioned the Lord. It said, I will strike them down.
So
but we know that he often uses a messenger.
So what's the Hebrew word for an angel of the Lord?
Here it's Malach Adonai.
I wonder in Pesach, in the Septuagint, it put angel of the Lord.
It could be, instead of just the Lord.
Yeah.
Could be. I didn't check. I could.
Yeah.
Also, the traditional angel of the Lord in Passover that we talk about that actually goes around and kills the people is the Mashchit. That's a specific word, where it's not the Malach Adonai usually. But here it's a Malach Adonai, and interestingly enough, my Bible has that very night the Lord's messenger. If you know, Malach is a messenger, and when it's a messenger from God, we translate it angel. But it's a messenger. Kings send out malachim also. And when a king sends it out, we never say the king's angels. We say the king's messenger. So we have an angel of the Lord. And what's the angel of the Lord doing? He's killing. He's striking. The same thing it says, I struck the firstborn. And when is he striking? That very night. And so in the middle of the night, there's like this terror of the middle of the night. And tons of people die. And in the morning, you have this dramatic sentence. Behold, here, everyone is a dead corpse. And what do the Egyptians say? Why do they want to hurry all the people out of Egypt? They say, we're all dead. We're all dying. Kulanu metim. So it's like the same phrase, but here it's saying they're all dead, and it adds corpses in it. And so Sanherib sees that, and he gets up, and he goes back home. So clearly, those themes are the same. God strikes down the enemy divinely. In this case, the people of Israel are inside Jerusalem, all locked up, and then the enemy is around them, but all the people die, and so they leave unexpectedly. In the Exodus, it's kind of reversed because the enemy stays in their city, and it's the redeemed that leave kind of unexpectedly. But they both happen in the middle of the night. And there's one last little verse we haven't read yet, and I know we have 5 minutes, so we'll look at it quickly. Zechariah 14:7. A strange kind of prophecy. You know, the one where the Mount of Olives is split in half. There's water. I'll just read it for you. It will happen in one day, a day known to the Lord. Not in the day or the night, but in the evening there will be light. So it's the same images of day and night. And of course, Passover, we didn't read it this week, but last week, Passover happens at the evening. That's when you slaughter your Passover lamb. Moreover, on that day, living water will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It will happen both in summer and in winter. So I guess it's going to be a real river. But if you read down a little bit, the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be seen as one with a single name. All the land will change and become like the Arava, for from Geva to Rimon, south of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem will be raised up and will stay in its own place from the Benjamin gate to the side of the first gate on the corner gate. And so skip to verse 11. And Jerusalem, and people will settle there, and there will no longer be the threat of divine extermination. Jerusalem will dwell in security. But then again, in verse 12, God's going to strike the other nations with a plague. And it's going to be so weird that their flesh will come off as they're even standing in their place. A day of great confusion. That's similar to what we've been reading. And look in verse 14. I think this is actually what connected this passage more than the in that day when we read. Judah will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered up, gold, silver, and clothing in great abundance. That phrase is exactly what they took from Egypt, gold, silver, and clothing in great abundance. And so, again, when you have this divine stepping in, a divine silencing of the enemies, the result, well, often here it's portrayed as a plague on the enemies, and there's a blessing to Jerusalem, or brought to the children of Israel.
And again, the animals will be influenced as well.
Yes, yes. And that's another interesting thing I was noticing when I read. In the following verse, this is the kind of plague that will devastate horses, mules, camels, donkeys, and all the other animals in those camps. And then after that, all the people who survive, this is when they're going to come up for Sukkot every year and observe. And because of that, they'll have rain. And specifically, Egypt is mentioned in verse 18. If they don't do it, they're not going to get rain, and they're going to get more plagues. So there's a lot of these themes brought back into play. Yeah, it's very interesting why the animals are punished along with the people. So as I said, when you look at all these texts we've read, there are all these similarities, even though the themes are quite different. And so it's more of a patchwork quilt, like you're jumping from times. You know, some, we've talked about Egypt, and they jump to Assyria, overcoming Babylon, and so it's kind of more of an artistic, I guess, picture, weaving them all together with the words. And a lot to chew on, but no one kind of like, this is what God's telling us by linking all these passages together. Except maybe, as I mentioned in the beginning, God is a watchman in the tower, and he's defending his people. So some of these themes, like Hezekiah turned to God, God makes a way where there is no way. That's like a very obvious theme through them all, even in the midst of the night. And I guess you could come back and keep asking the watchman, keep asking God how long it's going to be. You know, he's got it in control. So with that, I'll say Shabbat Shalom, and you can make your way down to the service. Sure.